to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Stealing Sunset by Punch Hutton. Police said there had been a recent surge of residential burglaries during open houses. How had my bags been smuggled out undetected? I wondered. John booked an early flight home, and after thanking everyone for coming, I climbed into bed. It was just after 3 a.m., the same time I encountered the first intruder, and the same time I'd wake up every night for years to come. I closed my eyes, but when a draft of cool air brushed my cheek, I sat upright and reached for the hammer. I approached the wall of windows and ran my hand under the glass panes, feeling for air. And then I froze. A dirty handprint gripped the window frame. Dark smudges covered the window crank. A shoe tread scuffed the wall. How had we missed this? Who had come through the window? And when? We filed claims with our insurance company, and when the AIG representative followed up, he interviewed us separately. "Do you have any reason to think your husband is having an affair?" he asked me. "Anyone he may have given your possessions to? How do you pay for things now that you're not earning a consistent salary? Why did you choose not to keep your valuables in a safe?" The line of questioning made me feel like the guilty wife of a cheater. "I'm required to ask these questions," he explained apologetically. "Insurance fraud has skyrocketed." I leaned in and asked, "Is there something I need to know about John?" And then months passed. People told me I'd never get my things back. My friend Vanessa offered to loan me anything you want. When John and I received some insurance money, my friend Susie took me to 14 Carats, a mini diamond district empire housed in a nondescript building in Beverly Hills. IYKYK, I guess. We walked the maze of glass counter display cases. So many options, so much bling. But nothing could replace the engagement ring John had made from a diamond passed down from his mother. The ring he proposed to me with in our first apartment on 10th Street in the village. I later ended up finding a cubic zirconia knockoff at the Four Seasons gift shop and wore it for 4 years until it turned my finger gray. My friend Natalie, whose Bel Air home was burglarized a few weeks after ours, encouraged me to join her as she scoured flea markets and pawn shops and kept close tabs on resale sites. She had actually found some of her stolen property this way, and when she said, "I'll never buy vintage again," I understood. I admired her perseverance, but the healthier direction for me was forward. "It's only stuff," I told myself, and even though many pieces carried meaning, what choice did I have but to let go? What I couldn't shake, however, was paranoia, which I tried to manage by becoming hypervigilant. The first intruder had entered through a side door that we had forgotten to lock, but the open house burglar, who was not the same man as the one in the closet, was a more sophisticated criminal. The thief had left our home in such pristine condition that I now obsessed over details. "Things aren't always what they seem," I reminded myself, spiraling into self-doubt. "Is the alarm faulty? Should I stop telling strangers salty is friendly? Did a shadowy figure just step into Ellery's room?" When we moved to Outpost Drive, I followed the electrician, locksmith and handyman around like Columbo, just in case they were actually casing the house. I also blamed myself. Maybe I'm bad luck, I told John, and went about trying to attract positive energy by burning sage, high-fiving the fortune cat at the nail salon, and collecting black tourmaline crystals. My new chapter wasn't supposed to unfold like this. You can get through this, I told myself. But trauma doesn't go away until you deal with it. On September 27th, 2018, Susie called her therapist and asked, "Can my friend Punch take my appointment tomorrow?" "But it's my birthday," I protested. Susie put her hands on my shoulders and said, "Happy birthday." On January 2nd, 2019, my phone started pinging. Nate sent a series of texts. One was a link to an LAPD press conference in which a person of interest, 32-year-old Los Angeles native Benjamin Eitan Ackerman, had been identified in at least one case in the spate of burglaries targeting high-value residences in the Hollywood Hills. The second text was a link to smugmug.com. The third asked, "Any of this yours?" My hands went numb as I scrolled through enough inventory to fill the first floor of Neiman Marcus in Beverly Hills and in Dallas. I swiped through colorful baubles, bottles of wine, necklaces and cufflinks with engraved initials, framed black and white photographs of Faye Dunaway and Mick Jagger, among others, watches from Rolex, Patek Philippe, Hublot, and Panerai. There were handbags and wallets, Hermes, Vuitton, Gucci, Balenciaga, Givenchy, Fendi, Chanel, so much Chanel. I saw bags that could be mine. I saw the quilted and the leather black flap bags with gold chains, but given their popularity, I couldn't claim them with certainty. And then I found it. The Navy Goyard bag wasn't proof enough, but the red PH monogram in the lower right corner was. "Oh my God," I said to John, "they caught him." We phoned the LAPD, and when Detective Jared Timmons got on the line, my questions came out in rapid succession. How did they catch the guy? Did he have an accomplice? How many victims were there? Why hadn't we been contacted? And also, would he like for us to come collect our belongings? Timmons explained that the recovered property was part of an ongoing investigation. Ongoing? You mean there's more? I asked in disbelief. He promised he'd be in touch. It took 4.5 years to get the answers. The stories of other victims are not mine to tell, but the details of Michael Gore's case, whose home was burglarized in July 2018, are key to understanding how they finally caught one of the most prolific burglars in the history of Southern California. Gore's and his wife were out of town when Gore's mother, who was also his real estate agent, hosted several open houses at their residence just north of Sunset in West Hollywood. When the couple returned home, they discovered blank spaces on the wall where valuable art had once hung. Other missing items included Hermes Crocodile Kelly bags, Chanel purses, 2 guitars, and a Cartier poker set. A week after the burglary, an art dealer called Gore's about a painting Gore's was selling by American street artist Retna. An interested party had reached out over ArtNet, inquiring about its value. When Gore's told her that the art, which had been wrapped up in his garage, had just been stolen, she forwarded to him the email inquiry. Gore's plugged the sender's email address into a site called Been Verified and did a reverse search. The name Benjamin Eitan Ackerman came up, along with his photograph. Gore's mother recognized the man as a broker who had attended several of her son's open houses. When she and Gore's examined the sign-in sheets from those days, they noticed that the man had signed in using his middle name, which he spelled slightly differently each time. That's when we felt like there was a strong suspicion that something was off. Gores explained. He phoned the LAPD to say he had a lead on his stolen property, but it didn't seem to ring any alarms. Gore's next call was to Michael Moore, Michelle Moore, the newly appointed chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. Moore moved swiftly, giving the directive to Captain Corey Palka to put his best guy on the case. Enter Timmons. 2 months later, a team of 12 swarmed Ackerman's apartment near the Mid-Wilshire section of L.A. at 7 a.m. Ackerman was handcuffed and sat on a couch in his robe while Timmons began taking stock. The retina was there, as were other pieces from Gore's art collection, which were hanging on the wall. A picture of Freddie Mercury, which had been inscribed to performer Adam Lambert, another victim, by the remaining members of Queen, with whom he was on tour, was found in the laundry room. Lambert's name had been whited out and replaced with Tibin, written in Sharpie. In Ackerman's office, Timmons found handwriting samples replicating artist signatures, hundreds of purses organized by brand, and labels corresponding to resale sites, including Bellabag and Fashion Pile. Fashion Pile. On the desk was a stack of Bridgewater Associates business cards with Ackerman's name printed on them. Timmons phoned the Connecticut-based hedge fund, which would not verify employment, but did confirm that the email address on Ackerman's cards was not valid. He had no job, no proof of income, no evidence of prior employment, Timmons explained. Ackerman was not a licensed real estate broker. I opened his desk drawer, looking for receipts, and that's when I found the paperwork for a storage locker near the Grove. Timmons obtained a search warrant and sent his guys to investigate the facility. Detective Patrick Aluoto called and said, "You're not going to believe how much stuff is here." He identified more of Gore's property, heaps of jewelry, including a gold necklace with Usher's name, another victim, hundreds of bottles of wine, artwork, limited edition Vuitton bags, available only in Tokyo, which had been reported missing by two separate victims. "That's when I said, seize it all," Timmons said. He spent the next 3 months cataloging more than 2,500 pieces of stolen property and setting up an account on smugmug.com so that burglary victims could identify and claim their items. It was at the time the largest recovery of high-end items in the history of the LAPD, Timmons eventually told the court, estimating the overall value at more than $5.5 million. Next photos, where the heart is. Putch Hutton's husband, John Hodges, and their children at their former house in the Hollywood Hills. And Hutton walks Henrietta and Salty back in New York City. Timmons linked 14 residential burglaries that occurred between 2016 and 2018 to Ackerman and identified 32-year-old Jason Emil Yaselli as his alleged accomplice. 10 were connected to open houses. 3 were the homes of Ackerman's friends. 1 took place at a residence where Ackerman's friend was house-sitting. In August 2019, the same month my family and I moved back to New York City, into a doorman building with added security, both men were arrested. Ackerman posted $1 million bail and was put on house arrest. Yaselli was handcuffed at LAX and booked into Men's Central Jail, where he served 112 days. Deputy District Attorney Jeff Stodell was assigned to the case in 2021, and when most of the world was still in COVID lockdown, he, Timmons, and I had the first of many Zoom calls. I walked them through the events of December 3, 2017, and emailed JPEGs of the handprints and footmarks I had discovered the night of the burglary. I made a diagram of our backyard and the side of the house with its low roofline, which illustrated how Ackerman accessed our bedroom window. They would not tell me if I was correct, which drove me nuts. "We'll tell you everything after the trial," Stodell promised. Our conversations were cathartic, especially because my husband had long since moved on. "It's in the past," he said. But I was still in therapy, working through PTSD. The constant feeling of vulnerability made me anxious and depressed. Stodell asked if I'd be willing to testify. "Without a victim, there's no crime," he explained. I had seen pictures of the burglars in the press. Nothing remarkable. I could have walked past either without ever looking over my shoulder, which made it all the more frightening. Ackerman came from an upper-middle-class background. His family was religious. He attended a private modern Orthodox high school in L.A. He had boyfriends, but no job. He financed his extravagant lifestyle by liquidating stolen property. He drove a Mercedes G-Wagon, one of his three cars, drank Opus One wine, dined at Madeo, and had the type of wardrobe that doesn't look expensive, but is. By all accounts, Ackerman had an addiction, and his drug was greed. Yaselli, on the other hand, was less textbook. The two met in a nightclub in Hollywood in 2005 and became pals. Yaselli was a licensed real estate agent, and while he never burglarized any residential properties, he did encourage criminal activity. Ackerman shared detailed accounts, photographs of stolen property, selfies in victims' homes, owners' identities, with Yaselli, who admitted to being thrilled by the play-by-play. The gory details fascinated me. Yaselli also enabled Ackerman, who had no bank account or line of credit, to spend lavishly by authorizing Ackerman as a user on his account and getting him credit cards in his, Ackerman's, name. Ackerman would use the proceeds from the burglaries to pay down the balance, he explained Timmons. In return, for every dollar Ackerman spent, Yaselli accrued airline points. Hardly the stuff of Michael Mann characters, but on one American Airlines MasterCard alone, Yaselli racked up close to a quarter million miles. Meanwhile, crime was ramping up in L.A. The longer we were there, the more stories we heard about home burglaries. Many pointed to Proposition 57, passed in 2016, which authorizes significantly earlier parole consideration for criminals convicted of nonviolent felonies. Under California law, most residential burglaries are classified as nonviolent felonies. The exception to this is residential burglary carried out when someone is inside the home at the time of the burglary. Residential burglary with a person present is considered a violent felony, which puts it outside the ambit of Prop 57 and carries a substantially longer sentence. At the preliminary hearing in April 2022, Judge Michael Garcia determined there was probable cause to believe the defendants had committed crimes, and a trial date was set. Ackerman was accused of more than 40 felonies, but Stodell knew that unless he was convicted of the three residential burglaries with the person present allegations, Ackerman would serve little or no prison time. Therefore, the legal battleground of the trial centered on proving the three counts of residential burglary with person present allegations. It was the only way to ensure that Ackerman would serve an appropriate prison sentence and that justice would be served to his victims. Stodell was confident Yaselli could help prove the person present charges, but as an aider and abettor, he found Yaselli to be as legally culpable as Ackerman. Stodell admits he agonized over giving Yaselli a deal. Stodell consulted with Deputy District Attorney Phil Sterling, one of the most formidable and respected prosecutors in the state. Only one not guilty verdict in approximately 100 felony jury trials and a 100% murder conviction rate. Phil's jaw dropped when I showed him the Ackerman case, Stodell told me. He wanted in. Sterling came on as co-counsel, and the DAs agreed to offer Yoselli limited use immunity for his truthful and complete answers during a recorded proffer interview. No promises were made, and any decisions to offer him leniency would be made based upon the evidence provided and a review of the entire case, explained Sterling. Yoselli was advised that his statements could be used in cross-examination if a cooperation agreement was not made. Sterling went through 82,506 text messages exchanged between the co-defendants and had Yoselli assign context and meaning, which further corroborated Ackerman's modus operandi. Sterling also contacted Romy Haas, an expert crime analyst who used location data embedded in Ackerman's phone to place him this close to the burglary sites and track his routes home. Yoselli turned state's witness and agreed to testify in exchange for no additional jail time. He pleaded guilty to one count of residential burglary and two counts of money laundering, and was offered 2 years of probation with hundreds of hours of community service requirements. He also had to relinquish all those frequent flyer points. As evidence mounted, Ackerman's defense pivoted strategy. 1 month before the trial was to begin, Ackerman pleaded no contest to all charges, 11 counts of first-degree residential burglary and 29 counts of money laundering, except the 3 counts of residential burglary with person present allegations. 6 years after our burglary, on August 24, 2023, the trial finally began. With regard to my case, the prosecution shared statements provided by our real estate agents that verified Ackerman's 2 visits to 8195 Hollywood Boulevard, once on October 22nd and again on December 3rd. He'd introduced himself as a broker scouting property both times. It was noted at the December showing that he spent more time in the backyard than he had inside the house. Among the text messages between Ackerman and Yoselli presented in court were these: 12/3/2017, 5/28/21 p.m. Ackerman: "Well, just when you thought the day was done." And there's a winking emoji. Picture of someone holding 2 of my bags with my jewelry inside them. 12/3/2017, 5/29/33 p.m. Yoselli: "That's you right now." 12/3/2017, 5/31/44 p.m. Ackerman: "Yep." 12/3/2017, 5/32/02 p.m. Yoselli: "Animal." 12/3/2017, 5/32/30 p.m. Ackerman: "Yep. I have been working this house for a while." 12/3/2017, 5/32/35 p.m. Ackerman: "Told you I'm good." 12/3/2017, 5/32/39 p.m. Yoselli: "And determined." What was not submitted into evidence, and what I found out about after the trial, was this exchange. 12/7/2017, 7/11/27 p.m. Ackerman: "Look up Punch Hutton on IG." 12/7/2017, 7/12/10 p.m. Yoselli: "Ugly." There was more, but you get the gist. "It bothers me that this bothers me. Who cares what they think?" John says. "But I feel like that emoji with the girl raising her hand." Even though Ackerman had admitted to burglarizing my house, I was still able to testify. The DAs believed that I could help illustrate for the jury a wider picture of Ackerman's conduct. He didn't just peruse the open house listings and randomly capitalize on a window of opportunity. He targeted 8195 Hollywood Boulevard by watching and waiting over several months, eventually returning with criminal intent. John was not allowed to attend the trial. Victims who may be asked to take the stand cannot be privy to testimony, so my mom flew in from Colorado. Her strength has impacted me profoundly. We had dinner at the sushi restaurant next to our hotel in Little Tokyo, where we shared a room. In the morning, I put on a red dress, slingback crocheted sandals, and a neutral shade of lipstick. We met Jeff and Jared, we were now on a first-name basis, in the lobby of the Hall of Justice, and together we walked across the street to the L.A. Superior Courthouse. The courtroom was not regal, with polished wood floors like in The Good Wife. But there was Judge Mark Arnold, Ackerman and his team, Jeff's co-counsel Phil Sterling, Catherine Zink, the court stenographer, a jury of 12, two police officers, scattered press, and the American flag. When Jeff said, "The people call Punch Hutton," I took the oath and said good morning to the judge as I climbed onto the witness stand. I wanted to say hello to the jury seated on my left, but I was concerned it might be misconstrued as trying to curry favor, so I purposely didn't look at them and then worried about being impolite. My anxiety ramped up as Jeff began his line of questioning, but by the time pictures of my house and the handprints I had found on the window frame were projected onto screens, my teeth had stopped chattering. I used a pointer to show how someone could access the bedroom window from a section of the roof in the backyard. "You unlatched this window during the open house and then climbed through it later," I wanted to declare to Ackerman, so he knew what I knew. I never looked directly at him until Jeff asked, "Do you see that man in the black jacket?" I swiveled my chair toward the defense. This was the moment I had been waiting for. The one where I would see remorse and contrition in his eyes, and part of me would find forgiveness, because I believe in redemption. But he wouldn't look at me. "Did you ever give him permission to enter your house when you weren't home?" Jeff continued. "No," I answered. The last thing Jeff did was present me with my blue bag, the one with the red initials. He asked if I recognized it, and how I could be certain it was mine. I told the court I had purposely and naively set the bag on a chair like a design prop, because its color scheme matched my bedding. I also pointed to my dress and explained that red is my favorite color. Five other victims took the stand, including Gores, Lambert, and the three victims of the person present charges. Yaselli testified over 3 days, decoding names and further defining for the jury the thousands of text messages, which provided a running narrative of Ackerman's hit list and proved he stole property from homes while brokers were present. In one instance, he explained how Ackerman not only stole a safe during another victim's open house, but hid it in a duffel bag, and then brazenly asked the broker to keep an eye on it while he finished looking around. The jury found Ackerman guilty on all three residential burglary with person present charges. Yaselli was the linchpin, says Jeff. In California, before sentencing takes place, victims or survivors have a legal right to inform the judge about how a crime has affected their lives. I underestimated how emotional this experience would be and attended the November 1st court date on my own. I went first and addressed Ackerman directly. "Was it worth it?" I implored. Not angrily, but curiously. Emotions flooded the courtroom as other victims read personal accounts of identity theft, the violation of personal space, stolen valuables, and betrayal. The psychological effects of trauma were obvious. The room went still when the last of the victims spoke. Rabbi Karen L. Fox, the first woman rabbi to serve at the prestigious Wilshire Boulevard Temple, and her husband, Michael Rosen, had been close friends of Ackerman's late mother for more than 30 years. The rabbi told the judge that the braided gold necklace Ackerman stole from her locked safe had been passed down from her grandmother Berta, who had used strands of it to barter for medication, visas, and ultimately freedom after Kristallnacht, when the rabbi's family escaped Nazi Germany. When Fox realized the family heirloom had been taken, she wrote a Rosh Hashanah letter to her family as a tribute to its legacy and significance. The legacy did its work, and allowed us to survive as a family and as Jewish people, she explained. When Ackerman accompanied his mother to console Fox at her home, Fox never fathomed that he was the burglar. When she told him about the letter, Ackerman asked for a copy, and I printed it out and gave it to him, she remembered. The necklace has never been recovered. When Ackerman's attorney asked if his client could read a statement, the judge deferred to the victims. We sat side by side on a wooden bench and unanimously agreed to listen. Had he taken responsibility for his actions, showed empathy for his victims, especially those with whom he had lifelong relationships and whose grief and anger were palpable, apologized to his family who showed up to support him, or given the judge respect, I would acknowledge it here. I don't believe you're sorry. I believe you're sorry you got caught, Judge Arnold admonished, before sentencing Ackerman to 31 years and 8 months behind bars. I was sitting next to Jared and whispered, "Is this what you guys wanted?" He nodded, and I squeezed his hand. The judge banged his gavel, and everyone stood up. I turned my back as the bailiff took Ackerman away. When it was all over, I decided to drive past our old house on Hollywood Boulevard one last time. It had undergone a modest facelift, but the palm tree and the sconces were the same. I counted the steps up to the front door and looked up at the balcony where Ellery and Beau used to play with the wind. I coaxed memories, testing myself to see if any love remained for what I had once called my dream house. But all I saw were nightmares. I drove away, relieved to have this chapter behind me.
Thank you.
Fear and Loathing in Riyadh by Bradley Hope. What could a movie star and Saudi Arabia's all-powerful ruler possibly have in common? Plenty, as it turns out. Behold the stranger-than-fiction story of how Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Johnny Depp into his kingdom and his circle of trust. Opening illustrations show stylized portraits of Johnny Depp wearing glasses and looking serious, paparazzi looking on, and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman with Riyadh in the background. He's smiling and waving. An ornately clad royal, draped in velvet and frills, sits at his dressing table within the hallowed halls of Versailles, awaiting a final dusting of powder. Just then, a courtier burst in with an urgent message concerning the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But this is not the 1700s, and the man in the chair is not King Louis XV. It's July 2022, and Johnny Depp of Owensboro, Kentucky, is having his hair and makeup done for his role in a French period piece titled Jeanne du Barry. The messenger is a senior producer with a surprising request. Prince Badr bin Farhan Al Saud wants to meet with Depp. The prince, an amiable fellow with a toothy grin, is Saudi Arabia's culture minister and a cousin of the omnipotent Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. In 2017, Prince Badr made headlines when he served as the front man for MBS's purchase of the world's most expensive painting, Leonardo da Vinci's Salvator Mundi. Price tag, $450 million. Not that Depp cares. No way, he tells the producer, I didn't sign up for this. The catch, however, is that Prince Badr has suddenly become very important to the production of Jeanne du Barry. By investing millions in the project via Saudi Arabia's Red Sea Film Fund, he has earned the right to an audience with the star. After a few days of back and forth, Depp reluctantly agrees to the meeting. It goes so well that within months, the 60-year-old actor, known for palling around with the likes of Keith Richards and the late Hunter S. Thompson, will stand face-to-face with MBS, the 38-year-old de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. Theirs will be a bromance like no other. With his willingness to spend billions of dollars in a relentless drive to transform his country into a cultural and economic superpower, MBS is shaking up the world order. To decipher his increasingly consequential moods, methods, and moves, global leaders rely on thousands of diplomats, linguists, and spies. They should probably just call Depp. Over the past year, Depp has spent more than 7 weeks in Saudi Arabia, staying in royal palaces and camps, traversing the country by yacht and helicopter, and even flying to London and back on MBS's personal 747 for a quick trip to attend the Jeff Beck Memorial Concert at the Royal Albert Hall. In that time, Depp and MBS have become real friends. They made a genuine connection, says a friend of Depp's. It's a shock to many of the people who know Depp, but it's what happened. Insiders say Depp is now weighing a 7-figure annual contract to promote Saudi Arabia's cultural renaissance. Both men knew how it felt to suddenly go from golden boy to outcast. Depp's stock had taken a hit after his ex-wife Amber Heard accused him of abuse. In two high-profile court cases, Depp contested those claims, which he has always denied. As Depp and Heard wrangled in court in the second case, a cascade of unflattering personal details hit the press and social media. The ugly spectacle and the troll war it sparked damaged Depp's reputation in some circles. For MBS, it was the horrific murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the hands of Saudi state operatives in 2018 that sent shudders around the world, irrevocably tainting the Crown Prince's carefully cultivated image as a brilliant young reformer. Reached for comment, Johnny Depp said, "Though I admit I was somewhat naive at first to what was transpiring in the region, I've since experienced firsthand the cultural revolution that is happening there. From emerging young storytellers, radiating fresh ideas and works of art, to a blossoming film infrastructure and a newfound curiosity for innovation. I've had the opportunity to meet people from various parts of the region who have been most welcoming in sharing with me their culture, their traditions, and their stories." Depp's introduction to Prince Badr was set in motion by Sina Taleb, a French wheeler dealer whose famous friends include Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. During a chance meeting in Cannes, Taleb and Badr got to talking about how to bring more A-list talent to the kingdom to support its burgeoning film industry. Rather than paying actors to visit, an inherently cynical transaction, Taleb said Saudi Arabia should invest in films to demonstrate its commitment to the arts. Under MBS's ambitious Vision 2030 plan, Saudi Arabia is plowing hundreds of billions of dollars into a kaleidoscope of ventures, everything from mining and real estate to sports and tourism. The goal is to develop new revenue streams and kick the kingdom's addiction to oil money. Entertainment is a key focus because it not only increases terrorism, rather tourism, but also persuades more of the country's 30 million residents to do their leisure spending domestically under the draconian rules that MBS started to wipe away in 2015. Entertainment was highly constrained. Playing music in public was banned. Men and women couldn't easily mix, and even simple pleasures like going to the movies were unheard of. 8 years later, the country is booming with cultural activity, some of which reflects the personal interest of its all-powerful crown prince. He's said to be a big video gamer, and Saudi Arabia has plans to invest $38 billion in esports and gaming. He's also believed to be an amateur DJ who loves electronic dance music, and the country now hosts the Middle East's biggest music festival, Soundstorm, every December. "We're making up for lost time and making sure that our country realizes its potential," a Saudi government advisor says of the country's huge entertainment push. Back in the early 60s, Lawrence of Arabia was shot in Jordan, Morocco, and Spain. At the time, filming in the kingdom was all but prohibited. Today, productions are flocking to Saudi Arabia for the scenery, yes, but also for the rebates, which can rise as high as 40% of the budget. "It's not just a prince saying, 'I want to have Tom Cruise come here,'" says producer Jonathan Gray, who first met MBS in France in the early 2000s. "It's the economy." According to Gray, MBS is a sci-fi aficionado. "It's really the capacity to escape your mind, thanks to worlds so different from ours, that makes it special for him," he says. In 2021, Gray's company, The Hideaway Entertainment, and Anthony and Joe Russo's AGBO shot scenes for Cherry, the first major Hollywood production filmed in Saudi Arabia since MBS's ascension 6 years earlier. The 2012 drama Wajda was the first feature to be shot entirely in Saudi Arabia. Starring Tom Holland as an American college dropout who grapples with PTSD after serving as a medic in Iraq, Cherry was distributed by Apple TV Plus and debuted to middling reviews. Gray says he's now developing Saudi stories for an international audience. One initiative is building a horror franchise around the invisible spirits known in Islam as jinn. His company receives funds for financing and development through a $50 million vehicle called Meridian Entertainment Fund, whose investors include Saudi nationals. Still, luring the biggest names in Hollywood takes more than cash. Many in the industry are nervous about the reputational risk of associating with Saudi Arabia. Khashoggi's murder is a major concern, and he's far from the only critic who has been targeted. Countless others have been arrested and detained. The kingdom also has a dismal human rights record and backward positions on LGBTQ plus rights, freedom of speech, and other issues generally sacred to Western liberals. Martin Scorsese declined an invitation to attend the Red Sea Film Festival last year, but not everyone is so skittish. The 2023 Features Competition jury was presided over by Baz Luhrmann, the Australian director of Elvis, The Great Gatsby, and Moulin Rouge. Others spotted on Jeddah's red carpet in recent years include Sharon Stone, Priyanka Chopra, and the Bollywood star Shah Rukh Khan. Vanity Fair Europe has partnered with the Red Sea Film Festival on several events. MBS relies on two members of his inner circle, both old friends, to cultivate foreign entertainments and athletes, Prince Badr and Turki Alşeyh, chairman of the General Entertainment Authority. A Ministry of Interior official-turned-poet who regales his 18 million Instagram followers with his latest compositions, Alşeyh 42, is the life of the party. One of his initiatives is the Riyadh Season, an annual series of concerts and spectacles, including a fountain show worthy of the Las Vegas Strip. Last year's event featured a boxing match between WBC heavyweight champion Tyson Fury and MMA star Francis Ngannou. A die-hard soccer fan, Alşeyh has also helped lead the charge to bring such icons as Cristiano Ronaldo and Neymar to Saudi Arabia's pro league. Meanwhile, Prince Badr, born 2 weeks before MBS, plays the cultural ambassador, attending events like the Venice Biennale and meeting the heads of museums. In the last few years, he has developed a coterie of prominent friends, who in turn introduce new prospects to Saudi Arabia. Among them is rapper Swizz Beatz, the husband of singer Alicia Keys, who has spent considerable time in the kingdom over the past several years. He shot an episode of his Hulu show, Drive with Swizz Beatz, in the Saudi desert. Swizz has a long history of advising the ultra-rich on art collecting. Before Joe Lowe, the alleged Malaysian fraudster, went on the run from the Department of Justice and other investigators, Swizz helped persuade him to purchase Jean-Michel Basquiat's dust heads for $48.8 million. Now, Swizz is advising Prince Badr on art acquisitions. If there are plans to display Salvator Mundi, they are closely guarded. Friends have learned not to ask, because Badr tends to excuse himself from the room whenever the painting is mentioned. Badr recently Instagrammed a photo of himself and Saudi Arabia's Vice Minister of Culture, Hamid Fayez, with basketball legend LeBron James and his business partner Maverick Carter. Swizz wrote in a comment, "My brothers," and then he uses 4 flame emojis, ending with a smiley face, laughing with tears coming out of its eyes. Like Depp, James and Carter were introduced to Saudi Arabia by Taleb. Intrigued by Taleb's advice to invest in Hollywood projects as a way of luring A-list talent, Prince Badr asked him to find some films that needed funding. "These guys mean business," Taleb says. So in the summer of 2022, he called an old friend named Thomas Langman, who had produced The Artist. Taleb says Langman gave him 2 ideas, Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis and Jean Dubarry, starring Johnny Depp. It turns out that Coppola didn't need or want any additional money, but Jean Dubarry was struggling to come in under its tight budget. With Taleb's help, Prince Badr and the film's producers arranged for Saudi Arabia to invest millions to cover budget overruns and some additional expenditures. The film's final budget was $22.4 million. Everything seemed in order, until Prince Badr asked to visit Depp on set. At the time, the royal cousin was staying nearby in one of MBS's houses. The $300 million chateau, set on a 57-acre site complete with moats, is called Chateau Louis XIV. Depp's wariness had to do with another Saudi prince he'd spent many years carousing with in New York and Paris and on the Mediterranean coast. Prince Abdulaziz bin Fahd, the fabulously wealthy son of the former King Fahd, MBS's uncle, famously traveled the world with an entourage of 24 hedonistic associates. They rented yachts, bought out restaurants, and generally partied nonstop. There was a dark side to these escapades. In 2012, a member of his retinue was convicted of raping a woman at the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan, where the prince had rented out a block of rooms. Suddenly, in 2017, Prince Abdulaziz stopped appearing in public. It turned out that he was caught up in the so-called shakedown, where an MBS suddenly detained close to 300 of Saudi Arabia's richest men, including his own relatives, on suspicion of corruption. The majority were held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh, the same venue that weeks earlier had hosted visiting CEOs and dignitaries for the annual Future Investment Initiative conference. Many of the detainees were released after giving up a portion of their fortunes, but a few have yet to reemerge publicly. One of them, former Riyadh Governor Prince Turki bin Abdullah, had allegedly been plotting against MBS. Depp's friend, Prince Abdulaziz, eventually resurfaced, smiling for a photo beside MBS, but he has kept a very low profile ever since. Upon hearing Depp's reasons for not wanting to meet, Prince Badr was able to reassure the actor that his old friend had been released following a temporary detention. He said Depp was welcome to meet with Prince Abdulaziz in Saudi Arabia, and even offered to let him look at the official corruption case file at one of the Saudi embassies in Europe. The openness worked, and the two men met. A few months later, Prince Badr's team persuaded Depp to fly to Jeddah for the 2022 Red Sea Film Festival. Once Depp arrived, however, he skipped the public events. Instead, a team led him on a tour around the country. It was Depp's first visit to Saudi Arabia, and he looked around wide-eyed at the changes underway. One person familiar with the trip said Depp bonded with Prince Badr, but also talked to a wide range of people: drivers, desert guides, young artists, and members of the royal court. By the end of the visit, Depp had apparently proved himself worthy of meeting the crown prince himself. They hit it off instantly. Depp's friends in London were alarmed when they heard about his budding relationship with MBS. But the edginess appealed to Depp, who was still recovering from the chaotic aftermath of his divorce from Heard, those friends say. He seemed refreshed by the time away from his hard-drinking friends in Europe and the crowd that surrounds his rock band, the Hollywood Vampires. "The trips to Saudi are actually healthy for him," a friend says. "Drinking is technically prohibited in Saudi Arabia, but VIP guests are still treated to alcohol in private settings, especially on yachts, because, as they see it, they are technically not on Saudi soil." Moreover, Depp, who did not recognize himself in the tabloid coverage of the Heard trial, was beginning to question the Western narrative about Saudi Arabia. The crown prince said the world had unfairly tarnished him as a bloodthirsty dictator in the vein of Saddam Hussein. "This was Saudi Arabia's greatest moment," he told Depp. "A major transformation, perceptible even on a monthly basis, if people would only bother to visit." He became a believer that this is actually a country in the midst of a cultural revolution, Taleb says. One of the key stops on Depp's tours with MBS and Prince Badr was Al Ula, an ancient oasis city that had been off limits before MBS came along. The authorities never said why the city was closed off, but it probably had something to do with a story in the Quran about how God punished the people of the area, known as Madain Saleh, with an earthquake that made it inhospitable to human life. There was also concern that Saudi Arabia's once powerful religious conservatives would destroy the petroglyphs carved into Al-Ula's cliffs by the same pre-Islamic organization that settled Petra in Jordan. But under MBS, who has espoused a more liberal and personal form of Islam, Al-Ula has become the center of a high-end cultural explosion. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.